ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you ever think that maybe the people making all the important decisions don't have a clue what they're doing?
Stable coins. Do you know what a stable coin is? Does anybody know? Please raise your hand.
The obvious solution to war is to have the West having the strongest, most precise, deadly weapons possible.
I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we take a look at every terrible decision that led to where we are today. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parliament is back this week with politicians descending on the nation's capital for a stacked sitting fortnight. And after playing hardball, the Albanese government is signalling some openness to negotiations on gambling reforms, particularly around inducements. But while the Coalition and the Greens called Labor's bluff, who will put their cards on the table first? Meanwhile, that infamous podcast appearance from the Prime Minister is continuing to haunt him, but this time for a different reason. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Greber.
Jacob, we've got a lot to talk about. There's the mandatory Monday poll chat. Let's just get this done because we say we don't want to focus on polls too much, but I think they do frame, especially before a political fortnight of sitting after a long midwinter break, they help frame things. So it's News Poll, a very reliable, I think it's fair to say, poll. Labor is neck and neck with One Nation on primary support, slipping to 29%. Labor's 29% primary vote is the lowest level since Julia Gillard was leader in 2013, and they've made quite a bit of this. Gillard's government hit 29% in News Poll just days before she was ousted by Kevin Rudd. Now, that's all of the palaver they're putting in it. My caveat, Albanese is not about to be ousted. That same panic is not besetting Labor. And some of the issues around Rudd, and I mentioned Rudd today actually in a different way in my column, but some of the issues were not just about polling, and that's the truth. It was actually the Labor caucus's way of moving on someone they thought was not capable of governing as well. So there was something bigger going on there, but that's a whole other history war. Jacob, what did you think of it?
It's starting to get pretty sticky, this downturn in the polls. It's enduring now for several months. We're sort of, yeah, there's a new low today. I'd say that's sort of within a margin of error type movement, but it's stuck there now at a level that does not allow you necessarily to win governments anymore. Historically, you would have said, no way you can win government with that kind of a primary. This is now a different world where the major party primaries are very low. So it's not an easy way to compare it. Even back to 2013 when Julia Gillard faced that kind of a number, just mathematically the way things work with preferences. So we are in a different realm. The other thought, Patricia, keen for your thoughts on this. He's been here before, that by which I mean in a sustained period of weak polling where he's not performing that well in those numbers. And it was after The Voice for about a good 12 months. The government really drifted downwards in the poll. There was a sort of funk that didn't lift until the beginning of 2025 when he shook it off and then went on. And here's the key thing, to win 94 seats just a few months later. I would assume that the operating model in many people's minds in the government is this is a normal midterm slump and you turn it around during the election campaign. And that's certainly what happened last time. Is the danger, do you think, PK, that kind of leads to a sort of complacency in the minds of some inside the government? They've turned it around before, they'll do it again. And by the way, this was the pattern in the Howard years too. You'd remember that.
Yeah, I remember all of it. And the complacency is a good and interesting word. I think the fact that they have turned it around before is definitely the guiding light, if you like. It's the reason the PM's not in the same funk I think he was in after The Voice, because he was in a funk then. It was obvious. You could tell just by looking at him, let alone all of the people actually saying it who were close to him. So I'm not seeing the same funk. It doesn't mean he may have learned how to deal with the funks better, right? Like, you know, let's not forget, I've done this job for a while now. I'm getting better at it. Like, you're getting better at your job. Like, you do, the longer you do your job, you learn your job. So let's not forget that prime ministers too have to learn how to ride the waves. And imagine your whole life being dependent on weekly or fortnightly polls. Like, seriously, like the sort of character assassination element of that is just absolutely brutal. I don't know how people are political leaders. Like, it must be menacing. So yes, back to your complacency question. I don't think it creates complacency. I don't think there's complacency. I think some of them are very aware that this is a very hard challenge, but I think they stay in the game, and somehow it's helping them, really, because they know it can be turned around, and it can be. Sorry, I believe it can be. I also think it doesn't mean necessarily it will be, but it can be. And if you believe it can be, the you know, same thing with elections. Any election is winnable. You know, you've got to believe it.
Yes, you have to believe it to get up and do those jobs. But I guess the point is more, it's the same group of decision makers that are closest to the Prime Minister. It's the same key ministers whose counsel he takes most deeply. They got through this last time. So they would probably be saying to the backbench, it's okay, we know how to deal with this kind of midterm slump. We brought out a budget that got a lot of criticism, that upset a lot of people, went a lot further than I think a lot of voters were expecting when it hit the tax changes beyond property. And there's a view in some parts of the government, well, we knew that was going to be an unpopular thing. We didn't do it because we thought it was popular, which is sort of, you know, an interesting bit of spin that I was hearing at the end of last week about those tax changes. The point is that every election is different. And if you're sitting there saying, well, we did it, we got out of the slump last time, we know what it takes to get out of it this time, I don't know. That feels like a risky proposition politically, because things have changed now and the mood is difficult.
Yeah, I don't think it's the same, but I think the energy from the precedent can actually help you as well, and also not help you. Depends how you use
it. Maybe this is the way to think about it, PK. That experience of having done it before is how you calm the more nervous voices, particularly on your backbench. And I think we're starting to see the tiniest little cracks emerging, or at least backbenchers are being given more permission to say things that they're concerned about. And two spring to mind just in the last week. One of them is Alicia Payne. She's one of the local ACT lower house members. You would think bomb-proof, unquestionably safe Labor seat. She's criticising the gambling stuff, saying it needs to go further because she's worried about a Pocock-type candidate coming up and knocking her off. So there's a little one. And then we also saw in South Australia, Labor MP for Boothby, Louise Miller-Frost. She also, you know, she wrote back to a constituent expressing her own concerns with the government's tax changes. So those are little signs, yes. I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I broadly agree with your thesis that, you know, complacency is political death anyway. And if you think, oh, yeah, it's just a midterm slump, no problem, don't worry, you know. But I don't think that's quite what's happening, though. I detect that the government knows. And a good example, and we'll get to it, is, of course, immigration. Why are they trying to pivot? Why are they having that discussion? It is because they do know, they do absolutely know that they need to neutralise some issues that are problems for them. They are working on it. So let's go to gambling, because you just mentioned it by mentioning the backbenchers that are perhaps being more vocal than in the past. So after last week's explosive evidence, negotiations on Labor's gambling bill now are dominating. I think there's a meeting actually midday today. We're recording this on right now as we record, it's happening. So who knows? We might have an outcome by the time you listen. But I think we will zoom out. That's what we do here, and talk about even the government's decision to blink so quickly, right? And what I say by so quickly is, you know, it's Monday, straight away. I think that goes to the nervousness around polls and other issues. I think Albanese sees problems and he wants to quarterise them. He wants to deal with them pretty quickly. This is a guy who doesn't procrastinate. Again, my column today, I compare him with Kevin Rudd. He's the anti-Kevin Rudd, right? Like, he's in control and he doesn't procrastinate. So he's trying to be on top of it. It seems like a tone shift. Yes, they've heard different voices on their backbench, but also they're not sort of going take this or nothing. They're changing their approach, aren't they?
They are. I think some of the way people interpreted what was going on at the second half of last week missed the point that they were always, the door was always open to them. There was just frustration on the government side that there wasn't a unified proposition from the coalition. And the coalition at that point was really still working out how far it wanted to go, because it was not all on the same page. Seems to be more so now. So we'll see. We'll certainly find out in the next 24, 48 hours where that lands with the coalition. They'll have a joint party room tomorrow where this is undoubtedly going to feature very heavily. And last week was a real watershed, I think, moment in this debate, because that evidence in a very quiet news week became a very large story. It reminded everyone again of the predatory parts of this industry. I mean, some of that evidence was extraordinary. And then it's no longer tenable to just force your way through with a little tidy deal with the opposition, because the opposition was changing its position internally. And there was a bit of bluster about that the PM would walk away from it and leave the status quo. I mean, I don't know what you think, PK, but that never sounded realistic to me, given the noises from the backbench. The idea that the government would leave the current system in place because it was too hard to negotiate through the Senate never made sense to me. So here we are, Monday. Let's see what comes.
What I think. I mean, anyone who listens to the podcast every day, and we're lucky enough to have that, will know I laughed. I literally laughed, and it was real laughter. Like, I laughed at that position. It's a laughable position for a government in the doldrums right now, saying take it or leave it, like they're sort of in charge of the asylum. Now, come on, go away. I laughed at it because it's stupid. It's a stupid idea that was never going to happen. It was completely untenable, not going to happen, and they have to negotiate because that's the world we live in.
So the question is, where do they land? Like, what is it that they move the dial on? And do they go the whole way that someone like Simon Kennedy, the Liberal, who's really pushed very hard on this, goes and brings in an opt-in rule, which essentially would be a de facto advertising ban? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it is a de facto, absolutely, advertising ban. And wow, if Angus Taylor goes that far, it will be, I think, kind of a moment for him as well, actually, right? That he's flexed muscle to produce this kind of outcome. I think it could be a really good moment for him. And I think the road they are clearly going to take is the coalition road. I think the Greens... It was interesting to see Sarah Hanson-Young talk in a more pragmatic way with David Spears on Insiders, but I still think the Greens always want to push, 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 whereas they're going to get something that is, slightly more industry friendly, because they've still got to give the industry, and you might listen to this and think, why? Well, they live in the political paradigm where, there's a lot of jobs in that industry. It's a really tricky one for governments to, isn't it, Jacob? Like it might sound, it's just so hard to walk that line.
But this is one of the realities of the role gambling as an industry plays now for governments at multiple levels. The state governments are hooked on the revenue from the pokies, and then the Commonwealth is also equally cognizant. And I know the Prime Minister's view is this, he tells people this, that he's worried about what it means for the revenue of big businesses such as Channel 9 and Channel 7, which are, I think in his mind, important pillars of our media landscape. And they are essentially self-funded. And if they were to collapse, if they disappeared, now I don't know if their business model is that dependent on gambling revenue, but if they were to disappear or become unviable, that's a major shift in our media landscape and all that might mean for democracy. So that's a view that the Prime Minister, is framing this issue with. So the idea that there would be an opt-in provision by which you have to tell the gambling company, you have to go to the effort of saying, yes, I want advertising on my apps, and whenever I turn on my on-demand thing, you'll see the ads. So who does that? No one does that.
No one.
And so that's going to be a big issue, I think. Yep. It'd be fascinating to see how far they go with that.
Yeah, that's a big one. And I'll be, as I say, I think it's a huge moment if they agree to that. I'm a little, I've got to say, I'm not sure if they will, but just think it's a, because it's so big, as you describe, how many would really choose to opt in, right? But the predatory inducements, Angus Taylor calling them that, I think that's the space that you will see movement and you will see some kind of deal, because that's because it's in their interests. It's in the government's interest to get what, you know, John Howard famously called the barnacles off the agenda. This is now gambling, in my view, is a huge barnacle for them. Took too long to respond to the Peter Murphy report, dragged their feet. Now this sort of tepid response, now getting pressured even from the right-wing side of politics to go further. It's all becoming a bit of a cluster, you know what word I want to use. They need to get it off the agenda.
A
they
cluster cannot punt be, yeah. is what you're trying to say. Is that it?
They can't be lingering on this anymore. It's just too, I'm going to say it. And I know lots of MPs listen to this because they tell me, and I know they're listening, as well as, of course, all our normals who listen, who are just ordinary punters. It's getting embarrassing, government. It's getting embarrassing.
Do you know, for me, I thought the moment where it really cracked was when Richard Marles, who was the acting Prime Minister last week, I can't remember, it was on the Wednesday or the Thursday, I think it was asked about that evidence in the Senate committee where we heard from the stories of drugs and other things being offered to gamblers. When he described that evidence as shocking, that's when I think that's when the shift was on. At that point, you can't walk that back. You can't say something is shocking and then not do anything about it.
And it just shows that 2 days of hearings were quite, they had such an impact. And that is, if I can sound a little Dagsville, go with me here, that is the beauty of the parliament. That is where the parliamentary process shines, my friend, because we had these only 2 days of public hearings. You saw what was revealed and what was spoken, and it literally changed politics, didn't it?
Oh, you're absolutely right, PK. It's a lesson in how parliament can be a powerful means of communication. And guess who's winning at that game? The folks who show up and become parliamentarians and learn how the system works and then use it.
So I want to move to another inquiry which is underway over the parliamentary break. It's been going on, and that's into Labor's NDIS cuts. Hearings ran over 6 days. They've received more than 4,500 submissions. This Thriving Kids program, that's the thing that they've come up with as an alternative, if you like, to NDIS for younger kids and that younger cohort who might have different developmental delays, different issues that are perhaps not a permanent issue that you need to be the NDIS on, but perhaps something that you just need interventions on. So that's my way of shorthand explaining what Thriving Kids is. It's due to begin rolling out in 8 weeks, but there are concerns now about, you know, is it really ready? I mean, it doesn't look like it. States and territories previously accused the Albanese government of pushing reform that didn't align with previous agreements. There's been a big backlash. The NDIS minister on Radio National Breakfast said he's confident that Thriving Kids can roll out from October. Okay, he's a pretty smart guy. I'm hoping he has some good evidence for why that's the case, because that's not what all the states say. The Greens want to keep raising this, and, you know, you can understand why. It's a big totemic issue for them. Is the coalition likely to support this, though? I mean, this is definitely right down their alley, right? Big cuts to the NDIS. They've been banging on about this stuff for years. Are they going to end this?
Well, I mean, I think what you're saying is surely they would like Labor to fix this problem and make it go away so they don't have to deal with it, even when they get back into power. So that's part of the motivation, sure, but it's also not their job to fix a problem that the government has responsibility for. And it's such a diabolically difficult problem because the role of the states is so vital. And this is, you know, this is becoming the real crash moment for this. The date's approaching fast when the states are to take over more responsibility under the Thriving Kids program. And that's when some of the resources pull back from the Commonwealth. And that's, we're only at the very, very start of this process that the government, that Mark Butler has mapped out, because that's going to last for years through to 2030 when they want to bring the numbers down sharply and put the thing on a more sustainable budget footing. But in the meantime, there's real world consequences happening very, very soon. And we've seen a bunch of reporting out of places like Queensland, where it's clear a lot of the stuff still has a way to go to get ready. You used cluster for the other topic. I feel like that's true for this one.
I think this is very true for this one. I just think this one is going to be really difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting too. The two things that we're talking about this morning and we've been talking about for a week were the two things that were put into inquiries in the Senate, to go back to your point about the Senate matters. Both were inquiries that were brought into life in the dying days of Parliament just before it went into the long winter break. And they've kind of filled this void in terms of policy being debated in Parliament and Canberra. So demonstration, yeah, the Senate sure matters.
Yeah, absolutely does. All of this is going on. The government needs that barnacle also to be sorted out. It really does. It needs it for its budget bottom line. It needs it for the politics. Let's not forget, it's there. They started the NDIS. They created it. So they're trying to balance reducing ballooning costs while signalling to the community they are still there for them. I want to change the topic again. A big sitting fortnight coming up, and a problem that I think the government thought had gone away and hasn't gone away. And it's kind of very annoying for them, I think, and that's that podcast, that embarrassing podcast. So that the ghosts of that podcast are haunting the Prime Minister again. Just remind you, it's the Bush Deep with Nikki Osborne, got the Prime Minister into hot water. He played that parlour game, shag, marry, date. I think maybe I've played it, or just the shag part, and I couldn't tell you my answer to that question. I mean, I could, but I won't. You didn't ask me.
There was nothing coming out of my mouth.
So in that appearance, though, so there was lots of bad bits. Everyone focused on the Kylie, and the Kylie was bad. Mm. She doesn't want, as my daughter said, she doesn't want the idea of the Prime Minister wanting to have relations with her.
No
one wants that in her head. Kylie deserves better. But the bit that I always thought was worse, in fact, we've talked about it on Insiders when I was hosting.
I think you and I both said this was the worst bit by far.
Yeah. It is, hands down. And it was when Albanese made this gesture in front of his chest discussing the melons that the Japanese Prime Minister had given him as a gift. It was very embarrassing. I thought it was the worst part. I couldn't believe at the time, I've got to say, that the Japanese side of the story didn't get outraged more. But they didn't.
It was very quiet. It was quiet for weeks and weeks, wasn't it?
And then
Just also one other thing apart from the gesture, he called it strange, didn't he? I think that was his description of the gift. It was sort of like an eyebrow-raised expression about, here, I got this gift of fruit. So I think that stuff, it's taken a few weeks, but you go, PK, what happened next? We've seen it now. It's finally happening.
Oh, we've seen it. So first there was an op-ed written in a Japanese newspaper saying, you know, our Prime Minister has achieved a lot, and yet she's, you know, subjected to this kind of talk. And I thought that was powerful. Now, Tokyo's former ambassador in Canberra has said the PM's comments were insulting in a piece in the Australian newspaper. Now, there's a few sour grapes. I don't think this particular former ambassador loved the Albanese government, it's fair to say, right? So that politics matters in terms of whether people have an agenda. I think that's a fair and balanced way to report this. However, it is still a former ambassador and, a sort of senior Japanese person saying that this is not right. And now it's put it back on the agenda, Jacob, and that's unpleasant, isn't it, for the Prime Minister?
Yeah, and I think this was inevitable, and he hasn't actually really given a full accounting of this part of it. He's kicking himself. He's furious that he did the podcast. He's apologised unreservedly for it, but this part to do with Japan is a little more nuanced and difficult. Two more observations. Tanya Plibersek was on Morning Breakfast Television this morning, very much saying that the ambassador had got the wrong end of the stick, which I think's a little bit like, you know, arguing rain is drought.
I was surprised that they said this, because this is the thing that I think is important. When we talked about it on the insider's couch, I didn't remember a correction. Did you get one?
Nope. No one said you're wrong, and that's a wrong interpretation. So I think, that felt like it was defending an indefensible position. He was part of that podcast. He took part. He did those things. You can't make it go away. So to say that the ambassador's got it wrong. And actually, as Barnaby said, it's not what you think it meant. It's what the injured party thinks it meant. And so you have the ambassador, the former ambassador, spelling that out. I think that's very problematic. It's also problematic. I think there's a little bit of a view around this morning. The danger for Australia is that it takes Japan for granted because it is a democracy. It's an important trade partner. It's a very important defence ally as well. This feeds, I think, a little bit of a narrative that more work needs to be done with the relationship. The Prime Minister has been to Japan. It was for a Quad meeting and maybe a G7 meeting. He hasn't gone there for a state visit, is my understanding.
That's very interesting. So, look, you know, this is obviously going to dog him again, whether it's just today or whether it's more lingering and longer, I'm not sure. But it just shows that it shows the original point we were making. You've got to be very careful about these things, and it's uncomfortable. And I do think that the decision for them to go out and say that's not what he was doing was silly. It might actually elongate the story, don't you think?
Yes. And I mean, the Japanese government itself's not said a word about it, as far as I know.
No.
It's been through a sort of proxy, like this former ambassador one of the reports today was saying had been an advisor or is an advisor occasionally to the Prime Minister. So it's a little bit of a sort of circular way to get the criticism across. I'd be amazed if they ever said anything up front publicly, directly. That's not how statecraft works.
No, that's not the way you do it. I mentioned earlier something that I want to just kind of just finish up on if we can, which is immigration. I imagine it will be in the spotlight again this week. Immigration Minister Tony Burke is not, we don't know the date yet. We might by the time this is out, I don't know. But the National Press Club address is where he wants to announce the migration changes. And my understanding is that's exactly what will happen. I don't think the Prime Minister plans to stand next to him and announce these. I don't think that's the way they want to play this immigration debate. It's about quietly doing the work and trying to neutralise immigration before the next election. That's the job, and it's Tony Burke's job to do. But I think it's really interesting to analyse just briefly just the level of authority the Prime Minister has, that they couldn't land on a decision while he was gone. I thought it was so telling of where this government's at, that he's so relied upon for his political instincts and also when there's a disagreement. Now, during that, I made a comparison in a piece I've written, we'll link it in the show notes, between when Kevin Rudd used to be away, everyone used to rush to Julia Gillard to get work done. It was like infamous around the joint and has been written about, extensively. Now, it's the other way around. One senior person said to me, it's like, big decisions, you want to wait for Albanese to weigh in. That shows how much authority he has. It also shows, I think, that there's no one who's second to him. And I think that's the bigger thing. Richard Marles is clearly not playing the role of Julia Gillard. People aren't rushing to him to make decisions. Who else? Jim Chalmers, I think, has been a little bit of a divisive figure inside of the government sometimes. So the Treasurer doesn't play that role. There are a few very, trusted people, Katie Gallagher, Penny Wong, who play very senior counsel role with the Prime Minister and are very much his Praetorian Guard. But still, they're not Deputy Prime Minister or playing that role. And so his power is quite supreme in many ways, Jacob.
Yep, I think that's a really interesting, to my mind, accurate observation about how it works. The reason people rushed, for instance, to Gillard to get paperwork through that had been log jammed was because they dared do it, and secondly because Rudd was in trouble. This is not a prime minister in trouble. He's actually just demonstrated that when he goes away, things drift, things don't get resolved.
Yeah, and polling is worse than Rudd's.
That is the strange paradox in all of it, isn't it?
But the paradox is because
the thing is though his polling inside the Labor caucus is not in trouble as far as we can really tell. He dominates, and so he dominates the government.
Yeah, and that's the story at the moment, and now he's back, and there's lots of jokes about they need him back, but equally he needs to turn his own performance around, if you like, or at least the story around for this government, and that's going to be the bigger problem for them. There's lots of soul searching going on in the government at the moment about how to do that. You know, back to your complacency question, I contest that. I reckon there's a lot of them that are very, very much got their head in, what are we going to do about this populist threat? How do we communicate with voters? What on earth do we do? And that's going on right now. And we're going to see it play out in the next couple of weeks. So I'll see you in Canberra tomorrow, Jacob. Thanks for joining me.
Safe travels. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, Parliament will be back and it's Census Day. And anyone who knows even anything about me would know that Census Day is one of my favourite days in Australia. Election days and census days and referendum days when we have them, my favourite days. So it's like Christmas for data nerds. That's all we talk about at my house. The kids are like, when is census day coming, Mum? Yeah, I know it's sad, but we are. Raph Epstein will join me to discuss all of that. There are some changes in questions. I know lots of different communities are excited about it. I know my own community, the queer community, is excited about some changes that will, you know, be able to recognise our families more too. So it is actually a really important data collection day too.
Who's filling it in your household?
Oh, my partner. She does all those jobs.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. My job is to get excited and talk a lot of crap and then the hard work. Do you know what I mean? Like I'm like, wow, it's so exciting, census. Oh, I can't sit in one spot to actually fill it out, you know? And you can pathologise me all you like. Send questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au and we would love to answer your questions. Although, Jacob, I do wonder, are you the one that fills in yours?
Oh, no comment, but maybe.
Yeah, you're such a nerd. I kind of knew that. I thought you're not giving that job to no one, are you?
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, of course you are. See you, Jacob.
See you, Pico.